content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the November 24th, 2015 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about the Great Cranberry Scare of 1959 and an article about how to be good from the August 29th, 2011 edition. And now, from the November 24th, 2015 edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Great Cranberry Scare of 1959 by Michael Tortorello. On November 26, 1959, Mamie Eisenhower served applesauce with dinner. Although the First Lady might have preferred not to make headlines with her choice of stewed fruit, the actor Rosalind Russell, a guest at the White House that evening, disclosed the menu to the national media. America had been waiting with more than the usual interest to see what the Eisenhowers would eat as Thanksgiving relish. The news came Friday, courtesy of the Associated Press. No cranberries for president. Ike's table reflected the nation's. The problem wasn't the berries, which remained palatable under the usual mountain of sugar. It was the aminotriazole. On November 9th, Arthur S. Fleming, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, had informed the public that a small portion of the cranberry crop from the Pacific Northwest had recently tested positive for the herbicide, which caused abnormal growths in lab rats. Ocean Spray, the dominant growers' cooperative, argued that a person would have to consume carloads of cranberries to trigger any possible ill effect. Nevertheless, Fleming had a message for the consumer, that is, the housewife. If she couldn't determine the origin of her berries to be on the safe side, she doesn't buy. A $50 million a year business collapsed overnight. In December 1959, the industry trade paper Cranberries reported that mid-November sales of fresh cranberries had dropped 63% from the year before. Canned sales were down 79%. Ocean Spray's market researchers found that almost half the abstaining shoppers intended never to buy cranberries again. For all his efforts, Fleming was hanged in effigy by Miss Cranberry of Modesto, California, who wore a long berry garland and, for reasons less clear, fishnet stockings. Vaccinium macrocarpone, the North American cranberry, may seem an unlikely villain of the chemical age. Early on, American Indians blended wild cranberries with tallow and venison to form a kind of pemmican. Later, Henry Hall, a veteran of the Revolutionary War, drained and fenced a marsh on Cape Cod and cultivated the first recorded crop. Over time, cranberry growers tamed the bog. In the mid-1950s, they began using aminotriazole, a chlorophyll inhibitor, to eliminate sedges, rushes, horsetails, and deep-rooted grasses. Sprayed by plane over cattail swamps, it also cleared the water for geese, which were not yet considered a weed on wings. Labels and growers' compacts stated that the chemical should be used only in the week after the November harvest to keep it off the finished fruit. But its manufacturers petitioned the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to allow small amounts of residue, up to one part per million, if necessary. In June 1959, 5 months before Thanksgiving, the FDA rejected the second of these tolerance applications. New research had suggested that large, long-term doses of the chemical suppressed thyroid function in rats, encouraging tumors, possibly cancerous, to form. The legal basis for the decision came from a late addition to the Food Additives Amendment of 1958, a piece of consumer safety legislation. The so-called Delaney Clause, named for James J. Delaney, a Democratic congressman from Queens, New York, imposed a rigid restriction. No additive shall be deemed to be safe if it is found to induce cancer when ingested by man or animal. At the time, researchers had documented four such contaminants: soot, radiation, tobacco smoke, and beta-phylamine, a dye chemical. In 1957, the journal Science had published research on the clear link between smoking and cancer. Just a few years earlier, the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission had begun to study the effects of ionizing radiation on the survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Testifying in favor of the Delaney Clause, Wilhelm Hooper, an influential cancer researcher, advocated precaution in the face of incomplete knowledge. "I do not believe that one can establish a safe dose of carcinogens," he said. "I do not think that we have the method or evidence available by which we can reliably determine a safe dose." In Rumsfeldian terms, the threat was an unknown unknown. In the end, a few bad berries spoiled the barrel. Maybe the plants had been sprayed at the wrong time. Once the tainted samples appeared in 1959 under a new testing protocol, Fleming believed that his office was compelled to act. With Ocean Spray's grudging consent, government inspectors started to seize barrels as if they were filled with moonshine. Still, some people stayed on the sauce. During a presidential campaign swing through Wisconsin, Richard Nixon tucked in to four helpings of cranberries, fruit from the same 20-ton batch, the papers later reported, tested positive for contamination. Not to be outdone, his opponent, Senator John F. Kennedy, downed two cranberry juice cocktails the very same day. After toasting the politicians for their braver stomachs, Life magazine published a holiday photo spread of all American fruits that could fill the cranberry gap. Were cooks ready to give thanks with side dishes like spiced crab apples, frosted grapes, currant jelly, and beach plum preserve? No? How about pickled watermelon rind? If Fleming was the Grinch who stole Thanksgiving, that character debuted in 1957, he also gave back the berries. In the days before the holidays, his department struck an agreement with the industry and released the cranberry lots that had been tested clean. At Christmas time, this represented more than 99% of the impounded fruit. Over the winter and spring, the government created a $10 million fund to compensate cranberry farmers. The market began to recover the next fall. Nowadays, we treat dietary panics as a national pastime. But the cranberry crisis created the rules of the game. The daily media commotion, the confusing science, the industry resentment, the political grandstanding. It taught Americans a new way to fear our food. In short, it is the kind of historical footnote that you could turn into a dissertation, which is what Mark Ryan Jansen did in 2010 under the title The Cranberry Scare of 1959, The Beginning of the End of the Delaney Clause. In one passage, a sort of footnote to the footnote, Jansen records the impressions of a marine biologist who attended the November 18th negotiations between Fleming and Big Cranberry. 3 years later, that observer, Rachel Carson, published Silent Spring, her indictment of the pesticide DDT, which laid out a framework for the environmental movement. And now, from the August 29, 2011 edition of The New Yorker magazine, "How to Be Good. An Oxford philosopher thinks he can distill all morality into a formula. Is he right? by Larissa McFarquhar. What makes me the same person throughout my life and a different person from you? And what is the importance of these facts? I believe that most of us have false beliefs about our own nature and our own identity over time, and that when we see the truth, we ought to change some of our beliefs about what we have reason to do. Now, you are in a terrible accident. Your body is fatally injured, as are the brains of your two identical triplet brothers. Your brain is divided into two halves, and into each brother's body, one half is successfully transplanted. After the surgery, each of the two resulting people believes himself to be you, seems to remember living your life, and has your character. This is not as unlikely as it sounds. Already, living brains have been surgically divided, resulting in two separate streams of consciousness. What has happened? Have you died, or have you survived? And if you have survived, who are you? Are you one of these people, both, or neither? What if one of the transplants fails and only one person with half your brain survives? That seems quite different, but the death of one person could hardly make a difference to the identity of another. The philosopher Derek Parfit believes that neither of the people is you, but that this doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that you have ceased to exist, because what has happened to you is quite unlike ordinary death. In your relationship to the two new people, there is everything that matters in ordinary survival, a continuity of memories and dispositions that will decay and change as they usually do. Most of us care about our future because it is ours. But this most fundamental human instinct is based on a mistake, Parfit believes. Personal identity is not what matters. Parfit is thought by many to be the most original moral philosopher in the English-speaking world. He has written two books, both of which have been called the most important works to be written in the field in more than a century, since 1874, when Henry Sedgwick's The Method of Ethics, the apogee of classical utilitarianism, was published. Parfit's first book, Reasons and Persons, was published in 1984, when he was 41, and caused a sensation. The book was dense with science fictional thought experiments, all urging a shift toward a more impersonal, non-physical, and selfless view of human life. Now, suppose that a scientist were to begin replacing your cells one by one with those of Greta Garbo at the age of 30. At the beginning of the experiment, the recipient of the cells would clearly be you, and at the end, it would clearly be Garbo. But what about in the middle? It seems impossible to suggest that you could draw a line between the two, that any single cell could make all the difference between you and not you. There is, then, no answer to the question of whether or not the person is you. And yet there is no mystery involved. We know what happened. A self, it seems, is not all or nothing, but the sort of thing that there can be more of or less of. When in the process of a zygote's cellular self-multiplication does a person start to exist? Or when does a person descending into dementia or coma cease to be? There is no simple answer. It is a matter of degrees. Parfit's view resembles in some way the Buddhist view of the self, a fact that was pointed out to him years ago by a professor of Oriental religions. Parfit was delighted by this discovery. He is in the business of searching for universal truths. So to find out that a figure like the Buddha, vastly removed from him by time and space, came independently to a similar conclusion. Well, that was extremely reassuring. Sometime later, he learned that Reasons and Persons was being memorized and chanted, along with sutras, by novice monks at a monastery in Tibet. It is difficult to believe that there is no such thing as an all or nothing self. No deep further fact beyond the multitude of a small psychological facts that make you who you are. Parfit finds that his own belief is unstable. He needs to reconvince himself. Buddha, too, thought that achieving this belief was very hard, though possible with much meditation. But, assuming that we could be convinced, how should we think about it? Is the truth depressing? Some may find it so, but I find it liberating and consoling. Parfit's words in his books and emails and even in speech all have a similar timbre. It is difficult to distinguish them. In all, a strong emotion is audible under restraint. Parfit continues, when I believed that my existence was such a further fact, I seemed imprisoned in myself. My life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. I now live in the open air. There is still a difference between my life and the lives of other people, but the difference is less. Other people are closer. I am less concerned about the rest of my own life and more concerned about the lives of others. It seems to a friend of Parfit's that his theory of personal identity is motivated by an extreme fear of death. But Parfit doesn't believe that he once feared death more than other people, and now he thinks he fears it less. My death will break the more direct relations between my present experiences and future experiences, but it will not break various other relations. Some people will remember him. Others may be influenced by his writing or act upon his advice. Memories that connect with his memories, thoughts that connect with his thoughts, actions taken that connect with his intentions will persist after he is gone, just inside different bodies. This is all there is to the fact that there will be no one living who will be me. Now that I have seen this, my death seems to me less bad. After Parfit finished Reasons and Persons, he became increasingly disturbed by how many people believed that there was no such thing as objective moral truth. This led him to write his second book, On What Matters, which was published this summer after years of anticipation among philosophers. A conference, a book of critical essays, and endless discussions about it preceded its appearance, based on circulated drafts. Parfit believes that there are true answers to moral questions just as there are to mathematical ones. Humans can perceive these truths through a combination of intuition and critical reasoning, but they remain true whether humans perceive them or not. He believes that there is nothing more urgent for him to do in his brief time on Earth than discover what these truths are and persuade others of their reality. He believes that without moral truth, the world would be a bleak place in which nothing mattered. This thought horrifies him. We would have no reasons to try to decide how to live. Such decisions would be arbitrary. We would act only on our instincts and desires, living as other animals live. He feels himself surrounded by dangerous skeptics. Many of his colleagues not only do not believe in objective moral truth, they don't even find its absence disturbing. They are pragmatic types who argue that the notion of moral truth is unnecessary. A fifth wheel. With it or without it, people will go on with their lives as they always have done, feeling strongly that some things are bad and others good. Not missing the cosmic imprimatur. To Parfit, this is an appalling nihilism. Subjectivists sometimes say that even though nothing matters in an objective sense, it is enough that some things matter to people. But that shows how deeply these views differ. Subjectivists are like those who say God doesn't exist in your sense, but God is love, and some people love each other, so in my sense, God exists. Parfit is an atheist, but when it comes to moral truth, he believes what Ivan Karamazov believed about God. If it does not exist, then everything is permitted. In the way that he moves and carries himself, Parfit gives the impression of one who is unaware of being looked at. Perhaps because he spends so much time alone. He clutches his computer bag. He fidgets. His hair is white and fluffy and has settled into a page boy of the kind that was fashionable for men in the 15th century. He wears the same outfit every day. White shirt, black trousers. There is something not there about him. An unphysical, slightly androgynous quality. He lacks the normal antisocial emotions, envy, malice, dominance, desire for revenge. He doesn't believe that his conscious mind is responsible for the important parts of his work. He pictures his thinking self as a government minister sitting behind a large desk who writes a question on a piece of paper and puts it in his out tray. The minister then sits idly at the desk, twiddling his thumbs, while in some back room civil servants labor furiously, come up with the answer, and place it in his in tray. Parfit is less aware than most of the boundaries of his self, less conscious of them, and less protective. Parfit is less aware than most of the boundaries of his self, less conscious of them, and less protective. He is helplessly, sometimes unwillingly empathetic. He will find himself overcome by the mood of the person he is with, especially if that person is unhappy. He has few memories of his past, and he almost never thinks about it, although his memory for other things is very good. He attributes this to his inability to form mental images. Although he recognizes familiar things when he sees them, he cannot call up images of them afterward in his head. He cannot visualize even so simple an image as a flag. He cannot, when he is away, recall his wife's face. This condition is rare, but not unheard of. It has been proposed that it is more common in people who think in abstractions. He has always believed that this is why he never thinks about his childhood. He imagines other people in quiet moments playing their memories in their heads like wonderful old movies, whereas his few memories are stored up as propositions, as sentences, with none of the vividness of a picture. But when it is suggested to him that an absence of images does not really explain an absence of emotional connection to his past, he concedes that this is so. Sometime around 1982 or 83, the philosopher Janet Radcliffe Richards moved from London to Oxford, having ended her first marriage. She had become well known a few years earlier for writing The Skeptical Feminist, a fierce attack on anti-rational tendencies in the women's movement. And she was teaching philosophy of science at the Open University. She was very beautiful and very feminine. She attended a seminar that Parfit was teaching. She had never encountered anyone like him. He was obviously a strange person, but not in any of the usual ways. Afterward, Amartya Sen, a friend who was co-teaching the seminar, greeted her, and when she left, Parfit asked Sen who she was. Parfit, I read some of Sam Schleffer's recent work, and he's arguing that people care about the future of humanity much more than they realize, and I think that's right. Richards, the Future of Humanity Institute people keep talking about engineering humans to make them more moral. I haven't got a clear enough view of what it would be, because it would have to be something so different from humans that I'm not sure why bother any more than turn everybody into termites or something. Parfit. Oh, no, you could. Richards. The essence of us is that the things we value are close connections and families and groups. And that necessarily means that we care about other people less. At the time, Parfit was preparing the manuscript of Reasons and Persons for the printer. This involved a certain amount of anxiety, but the enormous intellectual labor that had consumed him for 15 years was over. He was entering a rare transitional moment between decades-long periods of total philosophical immersion, in which his mind was, for a short time, receptive to other things. Parfit read Richard's book and wrote her a letter about it, suggesting that they meet and discuss it further. He went out and bought three identical black suits. They met. He offered to rent her a computer. He had just discovered computers. He had bought one secondhand and was very excited about it. With unpracticed but single-minded diligence, he pursued her. She was bewildered. An eminent philosopher had sent her a letter that in tone and content resembled an academic article. And now he was offering to rent her a computer. How much did it cost to rent a computer? He had not named an amount. He certainly seemed very interested in talking with her, and he was charming and brilliantly and unexpectedly good-looking. But what was he up to? He never flirted. He talked to her exactly as he would talk to a man. After a time, she deduced from the sheer frequency of his attentions that his interest must be romantic. But this was not apparent in his behavior. She began to wonder if he would propose to her before they had kissed. Parfit. I think there's great scope for change, even with no genetic changes. Richards. Oh, I wasn't talking about with no genetic changes. I was talking about the genetic ones they were talking about. Of course, there's scope for change, but the question is how much they're going to work with the material we've got and how much they're going to change it. And they wanted to change it a lot. You could see there could be a society of some kind of being that lived in perfect harmony, but I can't quite see the point. Parfit. Well, Nick Bostrom said that there's no good having moral, intelligent robots if they're not conscious. So he is aware that you have to make sure they're conscious. Richards. I suppose I just have trouble thinking that there is a point in having things exist if they aren't things that are wanted by things that already happen to exist. I can't see the point of bringing anything into existence out of nothing. I don't see why the world is better with creatures in it than not, especially as there's so much suffering. Richards didn't realize how unusual this transitional moment was in Parfit's life. Soon, having won her, Parfit burrowed back into his work. At first, this was fine. She didn't want a man around all the time. But then they decided to buy a house together. They had intended to look in Oxford, but Parfit lost his heart to a beautiful 18th-century house near Avebury, a Neolithic henge monument in Wiltshire. He had to have it. He bid the price up and was terribly anxious until the deed was signed. Then, happy to have won his house, he sat in his study with the blinds down. 10 minutes away, there was a glorious bluebell wood, and he loved bluebell woods. One of his fears about global warming was that it would get too hot for bluebells. But Richards couldn't get him to go there. It existed. That was enough. Eventually, she realized that her need for human company, modest as it was greater than he was capable of meeting. They sold the house. She bought a house in London. He went back to his rooms in the All Souls College, and from then until he retired, more than 10 years later, they spent very little time together, although they spoke on the phone several times a day. Around the mid-90s, Parfit started reading Kant. He hadn't read him seriously before because he had always found him irritating. His appalling sentences. It was Kant, he felt, who had made really bad writing philosophically acceptable. His grand eloquence, his infuriating inconsistencies and glaring mistakes. He felt that the crucial Kantian idea of autonomy, for instance, was just a blatant cheat. Kant wanted there to be a universally valid moral law, and he wanted every person to have the moral autonomy to determine the law for himself, and he just couldn't accept that you couldn't have both of those things at once. Parfit wrote, "I asked a Kantian, does this mean that if I don't give myself Kant's imperative as a law, I am not subject to it? No, I was told. You have to give yourself a law, and there's only one law." This reply was maddening, like the propaganda of the so-called people's democracies of the old Soviet bloc, in which voting was compulsory and there was only one candidate. And when I said, "But I haven't given myself Kant's imperative as a law," I was told, "Yes, you have." Things that mattered enormously to Kant, moral autonomy, motive, didn't seem that important to Parfit. He thought that individual selves were less significant than other people thought they were. So he wasn't that interested in motive. He thought that moral truth existed independently of human will, so he wasn't going to place much value on autonomy in Kant's sense. The driving force behind Parfit's moral concern was suffering. He couldn't bear to see someone suffer. Even thinking about suffering in the abstract could make him cry. He believed that no one, not even a monster like Hitler, could deserve to suffer at all. He realized that there were practical reasons to lock such people up, but that was a different issue. Parfit's first love in moral philosophy was someone completely unlike Kant, Henry Sedgwick, the British consequentialist best known for the methods of ethics. Sedgwick was very boring. He was so boring that he even considered himself boring. He was boring because he was very, very thorough. He would hedge each claim with so many potential rebuttals and counter-rebuttals and counter-counter-rebuttals that a reader was apt either to throw the book down in exasperation or to become so muddled in the jostling of hypothetical interlocutors that he had no idea what he was supposed to think. Sedgwick realized this, but he felt that it was more important to be careful than to be exciting, and that whatever value his work possessed depended on that care. He was a modest man. Kant wrote of his critique that it rests on a fully secured foundation established forever. It will prove to be indispensable, too, for the noblest ends of mankind in all futures. Sedgwick wrote of his methods that it solved nothing but may clear up the ideas of one or two people a little. But though there were other philosophers more original and more brilliant, Parfit felt that Sedgwick's methods, in its precise, dull way, captured more important truths about morality than any other book ever written. It was not surprising to him that a plotter like Sedgwick should write a better book than a genius like Plato or Kant, since he believed that philosophy was like science. Over time, it made progress. As he read deeper and deeper into Kant, he began to feel that the grand eloquence and inconsistency that had irritated him in the past were the product of an emotional nature so passionately extreme that it was simply incapable of Sedgwick's careful self-criticism. For Kant, something was never just good, it was necessary. There was little most or some in Kant, only all or none. Parfit recognized that he, too, was an emotional extremist who found it difficult to accept answers that fell between everything and nothing. But as he began to appreciate Kant, he came to believe that Kant was the greatest moral philosopher since the ancient Greeks. He began to be more and more troubled by the ways in which Kant diverged from Sedgwick, and by the way that modern Kantians disagreed with modern consequentialists, and both disagreed with contractualists. Kantians thought that you should act according to categorical moral principles that you believe ought to be followed by everyone. You should not lie, for instance, even if a murderer asks you to tell him where your friend is so he can kill him. The important thing is to do your duty, whatever happens as a result. But consequentialists believed that results, consequences, were everything. What was important was not motive or adherence to rules, but bringing about as much good as possible. Contractualists believed that the crucial thing was consent. The way to figure out what to do was to imagine the principles to which nobody could reasonably object. The trick was to arrange the thought experiment so that the consent wasn't the kind of pseudo-consent that had so irritated Parfit and Kant. It had to be the consent of plausibly self-interested people, not rational ghosts. There were brilliant philosophers of good faith in all three camps, he knew. So why were their disagreements so intractable? If philosophers just as clever and well-versed as he was disagreed with him, how could he be sure he was right? What if he could prove that their differences were only an illusion of perspective, that at a certain point all three approaches converged, like climbers scaling different sides of a mountain and meeting at the summit? Then he would be able to feel much more confident in his conviction that moral truths existed and it was possible to discover them. In 2002, he gave the Tanner Lectures on Human Values at UC Berkeley, proposing an early draft of his solution. He began circulating a book manuscript entitled Climbing the Mountain. One of his moves was to point out the problems with so-called act consequentialism, as opposed to rule consequentialism. Act consequentialists were purists. They believed that each action should be considered on its own merits, with the one simple idea of increasing well-being. But not only did this pose the considerable practical problem that most people would likely be pretty bad at anticipating the consequences of their actions, it would also make social life virtually impossible. It might make sense to lie to a murderer, but if there were no rules about lying, it would be difficult to trust anyone. Even the lie to the murderer would be ineffective. Similarly, it might in one case seem right for a mother to sacrifice her child so that 10 strangers could live. But a society in which mothers were always eager to sacrifice their children for strangers would be dreadful. So better to have a rule favoring maternal love and let the occasional stranger perish. Parfit's main task, however, was to prove that Kantianism and rule consequentialism were not actually in conflict. To do this, he needed to perform surgery on Kant's formula of universal law, the formula that Kant had claimed to be the supreme principle of morality. Quote, I ought never to act except in such a way that I could also will that my maxim should become a universal law, end quote. Many Kantians had given up on this formula. Kant had many others, concluding that it simply didn't help to distinguish right from wrong. But Parfit went to work on it, hacking off a piece here, suturing on a piece there, until he had arrived at a version that seemed to him to combine the best elements of Kantianism and contractualism. Quote, everyone ought to follow the principles whose universal acceptance everyone could rationally will, end quote. Everyone ought to follow the principles whose universal acceptance everyone could rationally will. He argued that these principles would be the same ones that were espoused by rule consequentialism. And then at last he was in a position to propose his top-of-the-mountain formula, which he called the triple theory. And here it is. An act is wrong just when such acts are disallowed by some principle that is optimistic, uniquely universally willable, and not reasonably rejectable. An act is wrong just when such acts are disallowed by some principle that is optimistic, uniquely universally willable, and not reasonably rejectable. The theory's principles were consequentialist because they would lead to the best results, optimistic. Kantian because they were universally willable, and contractualist because no person could reasonably reject them. Parfit wanted his book to be as close to perfect as it possibly could be. He wanted to have answered every conceivable objection. To this end, he sent his manuscript to practically every philosopher he knew, asking for criticisms, and more than 250 sent him comments. He labored for years to fix every error. As he corrected his mistakes and clarified his arguments, the book grew longer. He had originally conceived of it as a short book. It became a long book, and then a very long book, supplemented by an even longer book, 1,400 pages in all. With his triple theory, Parfit believed that he had achieved convergence between three of the main schools of moral thought. But even this didn't satisfy him. There were still major philosophers outstanding whom he admired, but whose views disturbed him. He marshaled every possible argument, however quixotic, to prove that what appeared to be irreconcilable differences were merely errors of little significance. For example, he says, when Hume claims that such preferences are not contrary to reason, he is forgetting or misstating his normative beliefs. We should distinguish between Hume's stated view and his real view. Though Nietzsche makes some normative claims that most of us would strongly reject, some of these claims are not wholly sane, and others depend on ignorance or false beliefs about the relevant non-normative facts. And Nietzsche often disagrees with himself. There were so many facts that we did not yet know, Parfit felt, so many distorting influences of which we were not yet aware, and it was always so easy to make mistakes. However hopeless the situation might appear, it seemed to him that, in the end, humans converge toward moral progress. When Parfit was young, one of the most dazzling figures on the philosophical scene was Bernard Williams. Williams was 13 years older than Parfit and already had a formidable reputation. He was urbane, seductive, and witty. He was famous for his eviscerating put-downs and scathing repartee. He acknowledged the originality of Parfit's work, but socially he was dismissive. Williams was a club man, a college man, full of high table bonhomie. Parfit would gobble his dinner, and while other fellows met for brandies, dessert, and cigars, he would hurry back to his room. Williams lived a rich, worldly life. He had flown Spitfires in the Air Force. He had lived for years in a large house in London with his first wife, the politician Shirley Williams, their daughter, and another couple. He had an affair with another man's wife and left his wife for her. They married and had two sons. He sat on royal commissions and government committees, issuing opinions on pornography, drug abuse, private schools, and gambling. He had done, he liked to say, all the vices. He wrote about opera. Williams had started out in classics, and his thinking was formed as much by Greek tragedy as by philosophy. He saw the world in terms of fate, shame, and luck. He thought most moral philosophy was empty and boring. He disdained both Kantianism and consequentialism and devoted much of his career to destroying them. Both required you to think impersonally, impartially, out of duty, considering others to be as important as yourself. But we cannot and should not become impartial, he argued, because doing so would mean abandoning what gives human life meaning. Without selfish partiality, the people who you are deeply attached to, your wife and your children, your friends, to work that you love and is particularly yours, to beauty, to place, without all that, we are nothing. We are creatures of intimacy and kinship and loyalty, not blind servants of the world. If he had a highest value, it was authenticity. To him, the self was, in the end, all we have. But in most cases, this wasn't much. Most people were stupid and cruel. Williams enjoyed his life, but he was a pessimist of the bleakest sort. He told a student that the last stanza of Matthew Arnold's poem, Dover Beach, summed up his view of things. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. Williams thought that metaethics, questions about the existence and nature of moral truths, was especially pointless. The idea of moral truth was a delusion, he thought, the fantasy of an argument that will stop them in their tracks when they come to take you away. Philosophy was an art, not a science, an enterprise not of discovery, but of conflict. Williams did not propose a moral theory of his own. He was skeptical that any such theory could be plausible, and anyway, his brilliance was fundamentally destructive. Parfit admired Williams more than anyone, almost anyone he knew. Once, Derek showed me a photograph of Bernard Williams when he was a provost of King's College, Cambridge, Larry Temkin says. Bernard was standing on the roof of King's College with a kind of haughty British aristocratic look. You know, master of all he surveys. And all of Cambridge was shown below in the distance. And Derek said, "Isn't he wonderful? I've seen that only once before with him. A picture of Rudolf Nureyev. Nureyev was in the air, above the ground, and he had that look on his face. In a certain way, it was similar to the one Bernard had. He knew, as long as he was floating, that he was sort of godlike." And Derek said, "Look at that. Isn't that just amazing?" Because he admired Williams so much, it greatly distressed him that their views were so very far apart. What he found most disturbing was Williams' view of metaethics. Williams believed that there were no objectively true answers to questions of right or wrong, or even to questions of prudence. To him, morality was a human system that arose from human wants and remained dependent on them. This didn't mean that people felt any less fiercely about moral questions. If someone felt that cruelty was vile, he could believe it wholeheartedly, even if he didn't think that that vileness was an objective fact, like 2 plus 2 equals 4. But to Parfit, if it wasn't true that cruelty was wrong, then the feeling that it was vile was just a psychological fact, flimsy, contingent, apt to be forgotten. For morality to matter, there had to be real reasons to care about it, objective facts about what was good and worth achieving. But if, like Williams, you believe that our only reasons for acting were our desires, then if a person desired bad or crazy things, to cause someone great pain, to cause himself great pain, there could be no decisive argument against pursuing them. Williams says that rather than asking Socrates' question, "How ought we to live?" we should ask, "What do I basically want?" That, I believe, would be a disaster. There are better and worse ways to live, according to Parfit. After years of agonizing over his inability to convince Williams of his position, Parfit decided that it only appeared that Williams rejected the idea of moral truths. that in fact he simply didn't have the concept. Williams had often said that he didn't understand what it would mean to have the sort of reasons Parfit talked about. Parfit had always taken this to be a rhetorical gambit, but now he thought that maybe Williams meant it literally. After all, he was a very brilliant philosopher, and if he said he didn't understand something, then one ought to believe him. This thought came as a relief. If all those years he and Williams had not actually been disagreeing, but just talking past each other, then there was hope for convergence after all. Parfit moved out of All Souls College last year, and since then he and Richards had been living together in a brick terrace house in Oxford that he bought some years ago in preparation for this moment. They are more or less camping. The house is in need of considerable repair, and they are sharing it with two Latvian construction workers who sleep in what will eventually be the dining room. The house was built for a smaller, daintier species than 21st century humans. Parfit, who is quite tall, strides through its pocket rooms and up its tiny twisting staircases like Alice in Wonderland. But the house dates from the right era, before 1840, and stands among others of its kind on a quiet, empty lane near the Ashmolean Museum. Now that Parfit no longer lives in college, he and Richards eat dinner together most nights. By explicit mutual agreement, they never discuss his new book. She has not read it yet. They do, however, talk about philosophy. Parfit. Suppose we discovered some technique whereby we could lengthen all of our lives so that we will live happily for a few hundred years, but the cost is we'd all be sterile, so we'd be the last generation. Now, your view might be, well, there's no moral objection to that. It's not going to be worse for the people who don't exist. They're never going to exist, so there's no one for whom it's going to be worse. Richards, I'm just not convinced that it is worse. I can see that we have feelings that it is, but I can't see any objective way in which non-existence is worse than existence. Maybe it is. Parfit, you don't mean that if a child dies young, who would have had a very good life, nothing bad has happened because the child doesn't exist, and not existing isn't a bad state to be in. Richards, I think once you've started, the reasons are there for the existing people. Parfit, well, I agree, they're not exactly the same, but the point in common, Richards, yes, well, they can have a point in common without it being the morally relevant point in common. You can't just say things resemble each other in some respects, therefore you draw the same inferences. Parfit, so would your view be, Richards, I haven't really got much of a view. Last August, after nearly 30 years together, they married. They went to the registry office and then brought a picnic to the river and went punting. Although they married partly for tax reasons, Parfit found himself unexpectedly delighted by the change. Richard's sister took photographs of him that day, squinting into the sun, wearing a red tie, beaming. One evening, Richards was helping him pack up his rooms, and everything was chaos around him. He was supposed to fly to America the next day, and he was trying to print out proofs of his new book so he could take them with him on the plane. He had a wireless connection from his room to the college office where the printer was, so he set the thing going and ran downstairs to check on it. But then something went wrong. So he ran up again and down again, becoming more and more frantic, and then suddenly he collapsed. He seemed to give up. I can't remember what's happening. Richards took him to the doctor. He had transient global amnesia, a syndrome sometimes precipitated by overwhelming mental stress. He didn't remember getting married. He didn't remember having written his book. The doctor asked him if he knew who Richards was. Yes, she's the love of my life. He recovered his memory after a few hours, but smaller aftershocks have continued. Many times he has broken down in tears while giving a public lecture and conversation in class. Once again, he is in a transitional moment, having finished a book and submerged parts of his life are surfacing. He is more conscious than ever of a shortness. How much more time does he have? A 14-year-old girl wants a baby. If she has one, she will be unable to give him a good start in life. If she has her first baby at 25 instead, she will be able to give him a better start in life. But that would be a different baby. So whom is she harming by giving birth at 14? No one. Not the baby, as long as his life is worth living. Suppose we who are living now decide to ignore global warming, with the result that the lives of future people are much harder. It would seem that we have made things worse for those future people. But in fact, as long as their lives are worth living, this is not the case, because if we had acted differently, the world would have been different and those particular people would never have existed. In the same way that if cars had not been invented, most people alive today would never have been born. So although we have made the world worse in the future, we have made life worse for no one. Parfit calls this conundrum the non-identity problem. He believes that it makes no difference. We still have just as much reason to avoid making life worse for people in the future. But he worries, rightly, as it turns out, that other people may draw the opposite conclusion. Since global warming will not make particular future people worse off, it may seem less bad. Parfit has always been preoccupied with how to think about our moral responsibilities toward future people. It seems to him the most important problem we have. Besides the issue of global warming, there is the issue of population. It would seem that if the earth were teeming with many billions of people making everyone's life worse, that would be bad. But what if the total sum of human happiness would be higher with many billions of people whose lives were barely worth living? Higher, that is, than with a smaller population of well-off people. Wouldn't the first situation be, in some moral sense, better? Parfit calls this the repugnant conclusion. It seems absurd. For a consequentialist, its logic is difficult to counter. We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5132. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.